Another Montana skier dies in a late-season avalanche. Good evening, I'm Connor Ballantyne.
And I'm Madeline Beck, and that's our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition.
Mountain Water Company announces new repairs to its Missoula water system. And in our feature interview, news director Sally Mock talks with scholar and author Stanley Katz about the importance of a global education. A southwestern Montana man died in a backcountry avalanche over the weekend. Anaconda Deer Lodge County Coroner Jerry Thomas says 46-year-old Ron Russell was backcountry skiing Saturday morning outside Anaconda when he was overtaken by an avalanche. The Montana Standard reports Russell was able to dig himself out and call for help, but he died of his injuries. He was skiing alone. Russell was a longtime math teacher at Anaconda High School. According to the Colorado Avalanche Information Center, he was the sixth person to die in an avalanche in Montana this winter and the 27th in the United States.
And in other news from around the state, Governor Steve Bullock has appointed Montana Workers' Compensation Court Judge Jim Shea to a vacancy on the state Supreme Court. Bullock said in a statement today that Shea has a reputation of being a fair and intelligent judge and lawyer. He says Shea's understanding and respect for the state and federal constitutions makes him well-suited for the Supreme Court. The 48-year-old Shea has been on the Workers' Compensation Court since 2005. He will replace former Justice Brian Morris, who was appointed at the end of last year to the U.S. District Court in Great Falls. Bullock's office says Shea will be sworn in soon, but a date has not yet been set. He must be confirmed by the Montana Senate next year and then elected by the voters in November 2016.
Three former Montana Republican Party chairmen have taken the unusual step of uniting to publicly oppose former State Senator Ryan Zinke's U.S. House bid. State Senator John Brendan of Scobie, former U.S. Representative Rick Hill, and former gubernatorial candidate Ken Miller released a statement today saying the Whitefish Republicans' views aren't conservative enough. They take issue with Zinke's past legislative votes on issues such as natural resource development and question his ties to a political action committee he founded. Zinke says the three see him as a threat to win the five-candidate primary over their favored candidates. He says he is fiscally conservative, pro-business, anti-abortion, and supports gun rights. Brendan and Hill are supporting other candidates in the June 3rd primary. Miller says he supports any candidate other than Zinke.
Early voting is underway for the June 3rd primary elections with more than 185,000 absentee ballots shipped to voters across Montana. Secretary of State Linda McCullough cast her absentee ballot in Helena today. She says absentee voting has grown exponentially since the law changed in 2000, allowing anyone to mail in a ballot. McCullough says 61% of the votes cast in the 2012 primaries were through absentee ballots. The regular voter registration period for the primary elections closes today at 5 p.m. People can still register and cast a ballot up through the close of the polls June 3rd. Late voter registration must be done in person at a county election office or at a designated polling place.
Missoula's Mountain Water Company has kicked off its infrastructure improvement project for the season, and for the second year in a row, it's investing $4 million in the system. The first of four water main replacement projects has already started as crews began relocating three water services near the intersection of Door Lane and Brooks. Affected customers there will be connected to a newer existing main. That project is being completed in coordination with the South Crossing retail development where the old Kmart used to stand. Work will also soon commence in the coming week to replace a water main along Grant Street. Later this summer, Missoula Public Works will, at long last, completely repave the severely rutted out stretch of South 5th Street West from Higgins Avenue to Orange Street. Mountain Water Chief Engineer Logan McGinnis says that presents a perfect opportunity to start a water main replacement project.
We're coordinating very closely with the City of Missoula Street Department. They're going to do a full-width street overlay, so we're getting our water mains replaced before that project, and then we sort of partner on the asphalt replacement and give them some money, and the city crew completes part of that work. So it's a great partnership. It's real important to get the utility work done before the street overlay work. So yeah, we have that project out to bid early next week, and then we're going to move it forward as quickly as we can because we do know that it's in pretty tough shape.
Mountain Water says it will also install 1,700 feet of new 24-inch iron main in Hillview Way near Moose Can Gully to eliminate older 20- and 8-inch water mains.
That's a pretty major street that people use to, you know, lots of people live up in there. There would be really minimal impact to traffic on that particular project. You know, it's, for the most part, we're not in the street or we're on the side of the street. So I don't want people to get the idea that there's a big traffic impact coming from that project.
McGinnis emphasizes that this work is all routine scheduled maintenance and not at all connected to ongoing eminent domain proceedings involving the city and Mountain Water owner, the Carlisle Group.
We've spent at least $1 million a year in water main replacements for, you know, the last, I don't know, 4 or 5 years. So it's definitely not something that has just changed because there's a lawsuit. You know, this year we're a little bit higher just because we've got a couple of big projects, you know, up to $1.5 million. But definitely that $1 million a year is something we've targeted as just a real necessary solution, I guess, to aging water mains and, you know, the leakage problem that exists. So, you know, the employees of Mountain Water are just really focused on continuing to, you know, do our jobs, serve the community, try to improve the infrastructure, trying to not really worry too much about, you know, legal issues that are going on.
The mayor's office had no comment on the matter, describing it as routine maintenance. McGinnis says Mountain Water's website, mountainwaterprojects.com, will continue to be updated with the latest information on all the local projects.
A 17-year-old was hospitalized in critical condition after a weekend stabbing in San Ignatius. The Lake County Sheriff's Office tells KECI-TV that a 14-year-old boy was arrested after the stabbing that was reported at about 1:30 a.m. yesterday. The victim was stabbed in the back and head and was taken to the Missoula Hospital for treatment. The sheriff's office is still investigating. There were several people at the residence when the stabbing took place.
A 19-year-old woman has died after her sport utility vehicle crashed into a creek in central Montana. The Montana Highway Patrol reports the woman's body was found shortly before 6 a.m. Saturday near U.S. Highway 89, about 25 miles from White Sulphur Springs. Investigators believe the crash occurred hours earlier. The woman was southbound when she swerved into the northbound lane for an unknown reason. She overcorrected and lost control of the SUV, which went off the road into a ditch. The woman was ejected as the vehicle rolled. The SUV ended up in a creek. The patrol is investigating whether another vehicle may have been involved. Marr County Sheriff John Lopp says the woman's name is being withheld while family members are notified.
A Butte man on probation for a felony DUI faces another felony DUI charge after being stopped on Interstate 90 near Bozeman. The Bozeman Daily Chronicle reports 53-year-old Craig Lee Barth was pulled over by a Gallatin County Sheriff's deputy who spotted his pickup truck drifting between lanes and driving 45 miles per hour in a 75-mile-per-hour zone. Charging documents say a breath test showed Barth's blood alcohol level was 0.246, more than 3 times the limit at which a person is considered legally intoxicated. Court records in the weekend case say Barth has at least 8 prior DUI convictions dating back to 1985. However, the Montana Supreme Court's Sentence Review Division upheld Barth's 5-year commitment to the Department of Corrections for a 2008 DUI, which records says was his 13th conviction. Barth remained jailed today in lieu of a $50,000 bail.
10 entities have submitted proposals to take bison from Yellowstone National Park that came through an experimental program to establish new herds of the animals. Applicants include wildlife agencies in Utah and Minnesota, 3 American Indian tribes, and private conservation groups in Montana, Nebraska, New York, and Colorado. Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks released details of the proposals today. Spokesman Ron Ossheim said the agencies hope to relocate the roughly 135 bison by the end of November. The bison were captured in the last decade, put into quarantine, and tested repeatedly to make sure they don't have the disease brucellosis. They've been held for the past several years on behalf of the state at a Bozeman area ranch owned by philanthropist Ted Turner. Livestock groups have opposed previous Yellowstone bison transfers.
A federal magistrate says she will decide soon if an Idaho ban on same-sex marriage violates the equal protection guarantees of the U.S. Constitution. U.S. Magistrate Judge Candy D. Whale told the attorneys for 4 couples today that the emotional case raised a lot of questions and that she would get a ruling out in the relatively near future. The four couples, all women, say Idaho discriminates by subjecting them to different tax rules and denying them rights given heterosexual families. Two of the couples were married in other states, and the other two were denied marriage licenses in Idaho. Governor C.L. Butch Otter, a defendant, is asking the judge to rule in his favor. Otter says same-sex marriage hurts kids and that states have the right to define their marriage as they see fit.
School districts in New Mexico's Four Corners area are going the extra mile to hire new teachers and are looking at the Midwest for help. The Farmington Daily Times reports several school districts in San Juan County have increased recruiting efforts as the number of students graduating from New Mexico teacher education programs has dropped. For the Farmington district, that has meant sending representatives to Minnesota, Montana, and Michigan to recruit teachers. Officials of the Aztec and Bloomfield school districts report that they face similar recruitment challenges. New Mexico State University Education College Dean Michael Moorhead says the number of graduates from four-year teacher education programs has declined since 2007. Moorhead cites pay and accountability mandates as factors.
The recipient of the 2011 National Humanities Medal from President Obama is in Missoula to lecture about the global century. Dr. Stanley Katz is a Princeton University professor, author, president emeritus from the American Council of Learned Societies, and an expert on American legal and constitutional history. In this feature interview, Katz talks with news director Sally Mock about the differences between the terms global and international and the importance of a globally focused education.
The way I think about it, international is really what goes on between states. And that is the sense in which we usually use the term. So it's the whole range of activity that crosses borders. And in effect, anything that crosses a border is international, and that's what the Latin means, between nations. On the other hand, global, and that's the harder one to convey to most people, global really refers to processes. And to processes that are occurring around the world or around much of the world and are happening simultaneously in many different places. So that climate change would be an example of a phenomenon that's global. There are other kinds, but that's the obvious example. So it's going on in a way that it affects the climate in every part of the globe.
It's transnational, would you say?
It's certainly transnational. But it's global in the sense that it really is everywhere and simultaneously. And that's very different because the international is more transactional, I would say.
And you've pointed out that American universities have for a long time been focused internationally, but only recently starting to think globally.
That's right. It's a much newer kind of thing, and it's more difficult to deal with, in part because faculty aren't trained to do it for the most part. We're just really sort of working up faculty who are capable of doing this. And the international has been part of the curriculum for a long time. So we have people who specialize either in foreign places or in processes, international law, for instance, international economics. And so we know how to do that, and we do that on a regular basis. But when you get something new like, say, climate change, that it usually requires more than one discipline. It requires looking at phenomena that are everywhere. And the difficulty is that what's everywhere tends to get ignored.
You also pointed out that in the 50s, during the Cold War, universities' international programs grew out of a desire to, quote, know the enemy.
That's right. That's right. And, you know, it's been a real problem for us because the major funding for international studies came beginning in the 60s, and it was a response to the Cold War. It was, for instance, to teach languages like Russian and later Chinese, and it really was know your enemy. If we're going to predict what those potentially hostile countries were going to do, we needed to be able to read their documents and speak their language. And likewise, we also trained faculty to study the politics and economics of these places. So international scholarship was funded by the federal government, the National Defense Education Act of 1965, and other legislation, and then big government programs for exchanges, the Fulbright program, for instance. All of that was driven really by our fear of other countries and by the tensions of the Cold War. So then when we get to the 80s, and those tensions begin to abate, and then by the late 80s, when they pretty much go away and the Cold War is over, so was the funding.
And you also have written that there was a xenophobia that went into effect then, in part because of the culture wars, and that began to sort of reverse the attractiveness of international focus.
I think that's absolutely right, and it turned out to be a real problem, because in this country there's always a kind of residual – it's partly ignorance, it's partly fear, I think, of foreigners, although ironically, of course, we're a nation of immigrants. Almost all of us came from somewhere else. But, you know, it's the last man in syndrome. Once you're here, it's yours. And so that feeling is very real, and it's reasserted itself to some degree, I think, and I think that's a genuine problem and a real challenge on a university campus to make sure that our students understand that they're citizens of more than the United States.
You've said that Americans are still in many ways parochial compared especially to the rest of the world. And what you said, quote, is Americans still command too few foreign languages and live and study abroad too infrequently. Our news media pays too little attention to the world outside our borders, and we are too infrequently interested in the rest of the world.
Yeah.
Still true today.
I think it's still true today, and I think it's a serious problem. Actually, since I wrote that, I looked up yesterday on the web. 46% of Americans have passports, and in Montana, 40%. I think that's too low. After all,
Denmark, it's probably 100%, for example.
Well, that's the point. Anywhere in Europe, it's probably 100%. And it's certainly too low. And, you know, this is a border state. You need a passport to go to Canada these days. It's disappointing that not more Americans do. And the languages is another kind of problem. We have, by the way, the great advantage that English has become the lingua franca of the world.
It's let us off the hook, hasn't it?
It's let us off the hook. But it's a problem, though, because it means that when you go elsewhere, if you don't speak a local language, you can only speak to people who can speak English. That's not everyone.
And your knowledge of the culture, because you don't know the language,
right,
is far less.
I think that's exactly right. So I think we've got a lot of work to do, and it's teaching languages. I think exchanges, educational exchanges, are important. Both of my kids studied abroad when they were in school. I think that's really important and hard to do.
But you've also, Dr. Katz, been somewhat critical of global education that focuses on jobs as being the main impetus for that education, because it often is. I mean, the pitch is often that universities need to be more globally focused because of economic impetus.
Because of competitive reasons.
Right. And you call this, quote, wrong, disappointing, and dangerous.
Yeah. Well, I think it's bad for education. You know, nobody's against jobs. We all want our students and our children to have jobs. But it's short-sighted. It's short-sighted in the sense that when undergraduate education in particular is focused on training a student to get her first job, that ignores the fact that in our current economy, anybody who graduates this year is probably going to have 5 or 6 or 7 jobs in her career. And what gets her the first job won't necessarily get her the third job. I think we need to worry about the third job, and that requires a more general education, a broader range of skills. So I think there's a presentism is a danger there. And I think we have to look further ahead, and we have to be a little less sort of short-term practical. And I think it's the short term that's what's wrong here. But also it's likely to drive, I think, bad educational choices. If, for instance, you think what you are going to study as an undergraduate is what will get you the highest salary in the first job, you may be making a mistake in terms of what education is going to do for you over a very long period of time. You know, I graduated from college in 1955. That's a long time ago. I've had a lot of jobs since then. And I think the very general liberal arts education I've had has really stood me very well.
You've said that the material that a student learns is not as important as, quote, the habits of mind formed.
Yeah. I think that's right, and that's, of course, what liberal education is all about. And it really is educating students to think in a disciplined way. It's educating them to have a good sense of values. Both of those things really combine to enable them to make good choices. And that's what education is about, I think, preparing students to make good choices, choices that correspond to their own carefully considered set of values. And nothing is more important, I think, in education. And if you ignore that, and if you think of education as simply training in tools, I think you're selling short what we can do. And I think, by the way, it's particularly important in great public institutions. Sometimes people make the mistake of thinking, well, that's liberal arts colleges can do that. But not true. The University of Montana needs to do that.
Especially in the world we live in, to be able to be as flexible as one needs to be.
I think that's right, because, you know, a student, you know, raised in Missoula or Butte or Anaconda someplace here, probably not going to wind up in any one of those three places. Going to go a lot of places, going to confront a lot of different things. And the world is changing in a very rapid pace, and I think our task is to train them to cope with what comes next, whatever that might be.
We have been speaking with Dr. Stanley Katz. He's a specialist on American legal and constitutional history and the recipient of the 2011 National Humanities Medal from President Obama. Dr. Katz, an honor to have you in our studio and a fascinating discussion. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Dr. Stanley Katz will give a free public lecture titled The Global Century, Not Your Mother's World, tonight at 7 o'clock in the University Center South Ballroom on the University of Montana campus.
Now for tonight's forecast. West of the Divide tonight should be mostly cloudy with a chance of rain showers, and lows should be in the upper 20s to mid-30s. Tomorrow, look for mostly cloudy skies with a chance of rain and highs in the 50s. In central Montana tonight, it calls for mostly cloudy skies with scattered rain showers and isolated thunderstorms. Lows should be in the 30s. Tomorrow, look for mostly cloudy skies with a chance of rain and snow showers. High should be 45 to 55 degrees. In southwest Montana tonight, it should be mostly cloudy with scattered rain and snow showers and lows in the 30s. Tomorrow, expect mostly cloudy skies with rain and snow. High should be 50 to 55 degrees. And now for the editorial comments of Tom Power.
Our aging old and bellicose new young cold warriors are rattling their rhetorical sabers and urging that the American military machine rattle loudly some real military equipment to chase the Russians out of the Ukraine and end the Russian intimidation of the Ukrainian people. I share the view held by most Americans and Europeans that Vladimir Putin is an autocrat and a thug who cannot be trusted to govern his own people and certainly not a renewed Russian empire. But I do not think that that is any reason for the U.S. and NATO to get involved in an increasingly hot war over what is happening in Ukraine. We need to step back and look at how we all arrived in this dangerous corner. First, recall some history. Ukraine has been at the center of over 400-year tug of war in Central Europe. Kiev is arguably the oldest of the Russian cities and an early cradle for the development of the Russian state. But Ukraine has also had ties to Western Europe, having been part of the Lithuanian-Polish Empire that once stretched from the Baltic Sea across Poland and into Ukraine. As a result, the divide between the Western-leaning Kiev region and the Russian-leaning Eastern Ukraine is centuries old. As the Soviet Union collapsed, Ukraine declared its independence. But that independence did not solve the problems with the Ukraine's national identity. Part of the Ukraine had strong ties to Russia and speak Russian. Other parts had strong ties to Western Europeans because of their historic ties to Poland and the Baltic states, and did not speak Russian. With the capital of the Ukraine in the western leading region, forming a unifying national government has been difficult. Elections within the newly independent Ukraine made this clear immediately. Depending on who was leading the government, the country leaned towards Russia or towards the West. Before the last national election in 2010, the Ukrainian government was exploring joining the European Union and possibly NATO. In 2010, with the votes of Russian-speaking eastern Ukraine, a pro-Russian eked out a narrow win without gaining a majority of the vote. In 2013, the proposed accord with the European Union was rejected by the Ukrainian president in favor of stronger economic relationships with Russia. With the national capital located in a pro-Western area, it was not surprising that demonstrations against the president began almost immediately. He responded in an authoritarian manner, seeking to criminalize the demonstrations and ultimately used the special forces police against the protesters. Quickly, however, almost no one in Kiev supported the president, and protesters began taking over government buildings one at a time until the president was forced to flee. The black masks of protesters seizing government buildings, which we have watched progress in the eastern Ukraine in recent weeks, began in the west, in Kiev, and is now being imitated by the pro-Russian protesters. So just where are we now? An extra-constitutional rebellion in Kiev succeeded in forcing an elected pro-Russian president to flee the country. An extra-constitutional pro-Russian rebellion in the eastern Ukraine is threatening to politically divide the Ukraine or trigger a civil war. There is no doubt that Russia is supporting the eastern separatists, but there is also little doubt that the U.S. and Europe indirectly or directly supported the pro-Western rebellion in Kiev. What is America's and Europe's interest in this culturally and politically divided country that has been divided for centuries and has experienced only limited periods of actual independence? The knee-jerk reaction by both conservative and liberals in the U.S. and possibly Europe, too, is to say that we have to side with the pro-Western folks in Kiev against the pro-Russian folks in the East. It is freedom versus neo-Soviet oppression. That seems to me to be an incredibly simple-minded and dangerous view. It is part of the urge of any powerful nation to impose its vision of the good and the true on less enlightened people. What would be good for the Ukrainians, the Russians, and other Europeans would be to stop trying to force a divided Ukraine to choose one or the other of the two powerful patrons. Putting a European nation and possibly NATO military alliance member on Russia's border using a nation which has as often been part of the Russian Empire as it has been part of some Western European country's empire seems like a purposeful poke in the Russian eye. Vladimir Putin may deserve that, but all of the other folks involved do not. There's an obvious alternative. Let the Ukraine continue to be a transition country bridging East and West in Europe. Let both superpowers agree to keep their hands off as the Ukrainians search for a decentralized method of governing that allows the Ukraine to stay a single country, independent of both Russia and NATO. Such a nation could draw economic and cultural support from both East and West, as it always has across its entire history. There is no reason to force Ukrainians or the Russians or the Americans and Europeans to go to war over a centuries-old divide in the Ukraine that ultimately could enrich that nation rather than destroy it.
Tom Power is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition. The views expressed don't necessarily represent those of this station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org or on Montana Public Radio's Facebook page. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Madeline Beck.
And I'm Connor Ballantyne. Thanks for listening, and please join Edward O'Brien tomorrow at 7, 8, and 8:30 for Montana Morning News.